You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Daniel Freeber and welcome to a special episode of the Cycling Podcast. Special because in lieu of our usual weekly episode, mainly because I've been extremely busy with Giro d'Italia preparations, we're serving up something else that is a taste, or some small plates, if you will. I hate small plates, but samples of the six special Kilometre Zero episodes that have either been released earlier this month or will be in the next week. As many of you know, Kilometre Zero episodes are usually reserved for friends of the Cycling Podcast. Becoming a friend entitles you to one-click access to all of our previous friend specials and Kilometre Zeros and Kilometre Zeros for the next year. Equally importantly, from our point of view, your support facilitates our coverage all year round and particularly on the ground at the Grand Tours. You can sign up, become a friend at the following address: thecyclingpodcast, that's all one word, .supportingcast.fm. Supportingcast, that is all one word as well. I'm heading to Italy for the Giro d'Italia next week, of course, and it's there that we'll start today's mini-series of Kilometre Zero sneak peeks. Most of our listeners are aware, I'm pretty sure, that Tadej Pogacar is attempting the first Giro d'Italia Tour de France double since Marco Pantani's in 1998, and that the double, or doubles in general, is the overarching theme for three Giro Vagando Kilometre Zeros we'll release for Friends of the Cycling Podcast next week, in addition to the usual XL Giro preview that will go out on our regular free-to-access feed. During the Giro itself, incidentally, we'll be releasing further Kilometre Zeros on the two rest days, mainly so as not to drown you in content every other day when we'll be doing our normal, again, free-to-access stage episodes. Doubles then, and what better place to start than the last one, Pantani's in 1998. Entitled Love and Other Drugs, this episode will revisit Il Pirata's epic duel with Pavel Tonkov, my enduring fascination with Tonkov, and other scandals, intrigue, and mystery thrown up along the way. Here's your little antipasto of that episode coming next week.
Ed ecco l'attacco di Pantani. Pantani, Guerrini e Tonkov. Può aver avuto ragione Cribiori, e ve l'avevamo subito riferito in apertura di cronaca.
Hi everybody, I'm Giacomo Pellizzari. I'm an Italian writer and journalist, and also a cyclist, an amateur. And I wrote my last book, La Mappa del Pirata, The Pirate's Map, which is a story of the most impressive and inspiring spots where Marco Pantani made his legend. Not just those where he won, but also those where he lose, or where he lost himself. Il tratto tra Malga Ciappelle e Capanna Bil, che è un pezzo della...
The stretch between Malga Ciappelle and Capanna Bil, which is part of the climb to the Passo Ferraia, has been tackled several times by the Giro d'Italia, because we're in the heart of the Dolomites, which are a UNESCO heritage site. In fact, sort of under the brim of the Queen of the Dolomites, the Marmolada, the highest peak in the range. Tonkov had already done the Ferraia in the Giro, but this was the first time the race had approached it through the Serai di Sottoguda, which is this very deep, spectacular canyon cutting between rock faces with a stream running through it, just below Malga Ciappelle, Malga being an old mountain hut. And it's here that this really brutal, very straight section of the Ferraia starts. Brutal, and in this case for Pantani, but only Pantani, deceptive, because Roberto Conti, his domestique, was supposed to tell Pantani where to attack. Only Conti was obviously too lost in the moment, or his suffering, and forgot. So Pantani rides alongside Conti and says to him in his broad Romagnolo dialect, "So when does this bloody marmalade start?" And Conti looks at Pantani like he's lost his mind and says, "Marco, started a few kilometers ago." And so Pantani finally attacks, drops Zula first, then Tonkov, and sets off towards the summit.
Avversari e vai in vetta, e quella poi sarà la tappa in cui.
Anche Pavel Tonko, sì, l'abbiamo visto. In difficoltà, Pavel Tonko e Zulle con una.
So Brian,
the graveyard of many hopes, the Passo Ferraia, and particularly that stretch from Malga Chapela to Capanna Bil, which, well, those names have really become enshrined in sort of Italian cycling and Giro folklore, largely as a result of what happened that day in 1998. And, well, they were certainly a source of great fascination for me, although the rider that I was supporting, the rider that was the apple of my eye, Pavel Tonkov, had lost time. And Marco Pantani, meanwhile, finally, Brian, this was a significant moment in the career of Pantani, wasn't it? Because he's career until he'd taken the pink jersey, I was about to say, and his career until that point had been that of a sort of valiant, heroic loser, or bridesmaid, pure climber, but someone who looked as though he was always going to fall short. I mean, you mentioned the time he lost in the time trial, and that had been the story of those grand tours that he had ridden and sort of starred in the 90s, whether they were the Giro d'Italia or the Tour de France. And Pantani taking the pink jersey and looking as though he might finally become a champion, it was the outcome that Italy had been waiting for, but it was almost an unlikely outcome, wasn't it? It seemed improbable.
Bellissima notizia. Allora, Guerini vince la tappa. Pantani ufficial.
Yeah, and it was also because they knew his Achilles heel on the time trial, and seeing that there was a time trial, final time trial, it was just a question of would he be able to take enough time on those big Dolomite stages to be able to defend however margin he would have before the time trial.
I mean, just on Tonkov, 29 years old in 1998. I mentioned earlier on that he'd won the Giro d'Italia in 1996. He'd also won the Tour de Suisse in 1995 and had lost the Giro to Ivan Gotti, or had been defeated by Ivan Gotti in 1997 in what was another sort of ding-dong duel. And that had been seen as a huge disappointment for Mappe, and almost a bit of a choke by Tonkov. He'd lost the Giro, particularly on the stage, to Cervinia, the Matterhorn. But where else could this fascination have come from? Some of it was the mystery, Brian. He was from this place called Ijavšt, which is about 1,000 kilometers east of Moscow, close to the Ural Mountains. But obviously we're talking about a time when information was relatively scarce compared to what it is today. And even if you go back and read the reports of the time in the Italian press, there was this kind of vagueness about Tonkov and where he was from. He was sort of described as being from the Russian steppe, the tundra, the middle of Siberia. Just aesthetically, he had these eyes like sort of frozen mountain lakes, very kind of inscrutable, these incredible cut glass cheekbones. He'd made his way into the sort of top tier of European cycling, like a lot of Russian former Soviet riders of that time. Obviously, he'd begun his amateur career still under the Soviet regime, and a lot of them had come to Italy via a route paved by Ernesto Colnago, the legendary frame builder. And he'd sort of got Tonkov into the Lamprey, what became the Lamprey organization, and then Tonkov had burst onto the scene really at the Settimana Bergamasca in 1992. He dominated that race and had also settled, I said the Settimana Bergamasca, that's based in and around Bergamo, and had settled in Bergamo and become very much part of he'd become a fixture of what was a huge community of professionals living in Bergamo. Bergamo was really the center of the cycling universe in 1992. So that kind of inscrutable quality that Tonkov had, this sort of stoicism about him, and his style on the bike. He was also very, very still on the bike, quite stylish as well. They were also qualities, characteristics that I think sucked me in.
In the Piancavallo ski resort, we eat the press buffet in a large open bar area where TV screens show the stage. Daniel is very quiet and keeps glancing over his shoulder. He's distracted, preoccupied, troubled, I'd say. Eventually, leaning in, he whispers, "Tonkov." "What?" "Next table, Pavel Tonkov, childhood hero." The boyish Tonkov, instantly recognisable for his cheekbones, is sitting in jeans and trainers, man bag slung over his shoulder. He's 48, but looks about 18. A great advert for the diet of a 1990s professional cyclist. Tonkov won the Giro in 1996, and it was the Giro, perhaps because he mainly rode for Italian teams, that showcased his talent and his class. He's best known for his head-to-heads with Marco Pantani. They were a contrast in styles, Pantani swashbuckling and attacking in and out of the saddle. Tonkov always seated, grinding it out, but smooth as silk. Still, it is unusual for a millennial, as Daniel very nearly is, to favour Tonkov over Pantani. Then again, Daniel is unusual.
So doubles, we said, but not necessarily cycling doubles. The Giro's Grande Partenza from Turin on May the 4th will be a joyous but also sombre occasion, for it marks the 75th anniversary of the air disaster that killed Italy's greatest ever football team, and the first to do the Italian League and Cup double, the Scudetto and the Coppa Italia, in the same season. The episode features Herbie Sykes, John Foote and Diego Fornero, the journalist behind the magnificent podcast series Gli Invincibili, The Invincibles, about the team known throughout Italy both now and then by their epithet, Grande Torino. The soundtrack for the episode is the beautiful Un Giorno di Pioggia, or A Rainy Day, written and performed by Torino fans Senso Unico, who kindly gave us their permission to use the song here.
Quel giorno di pioggia, bambino, lo sai che il cuore mio a pezzi non scorderà mai. Sul viso una ruga che prima non c'era. Lo sguardo nel vuoto.
My name's John Foote. I'm professor of modern Italian history at the University of Bristol and author of a book called Pedalari, the history of Italian cycling. So it was really quite a pointless game. There was no real reason for it. Apparently, there was some money involved. Mazzola had promised that they would play this friendly to his friend who played for Benfica. You know, the various rumours. There are lots of myths and rumours around this, as you can imagine. They jetted off almost the entire team. There was one defender who was injured, who didn't get on the plane, and the manager, and coaches, including an English coach, actually, Leslie Leavesley, who was the assistant, which is also another interesting kind of by story. They jetted off to Benfica on the way back. You have to imagine, people who don't know Turin, that it's a flat city, but it's surrounded by mountains and hills. And one of the hills has on top of it this amazingly beautiful church. Architect was Filippo Juvara. It's a very important church in Italian history because where the royal family were buried for many years, the royal family were from Turin, the Savoia. So it's a historically important church. And it's right above Turin. You can see it from anywhere. The plane was coming back. There were again lots of rumours about why this happened, lots of conspiracy theories. The plane was coming back. It lost visibility and it smashed into the back of the hill, really into the back of the church almost, right above Turin. And everybody was killed. I mean, there were horrific pictures of the bits of the plane, you know, half the plane left. And the person who identified the bodies was Vittorio Pozzo, who was the manager, who'd been a manager of the national team and was still the manager of the national team after the war. He'd won two World Cups in 34 and 38 and had chosen 10 of the Torino team for the Italian team. And he had the horrible task, he knew all the players, obviously, of identifying the bodies. He wrote a very beautiful piece for the newspapers. He was also a journalist at that time. So everybody was killed. People can't believe it. It's a complete trauma and shock because 1 minute to the next, this team is wiped out. You know, nobody survives apart from this defender who everyone thinks has died, who wasn't on the plane. Everyone dies. The manager dies. It's horrific. And the funeral was absolutely enormous. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people. But people are literally traumatized. I spoke to people in the 90s when I was writing my book who were still, you know, pretty would still cry when they told me the story. So it's a horrible story. And for Torino, the city, and for the team, it's something in some ways they never recover from. Because this team is awarded the championship. It's fifth in a row. It was like points ahead. They basically play the games out with their youth team, but they were given the championship. But it only ever wins one more since then, right? Which is pretty, you know, traumatic as well.
I mean, you in your book talk about how even Italian football en masse and even the national team is affected for the next 20 years. They reached the final of the World Cup in 1970, but until that point, the national team itself is still kind of reeling from the tragedy.
Yeah, it has a direct effect on the national team, not just because of the loss of players, but also there's this paranoia about flying. So they didn't fly to the World Cup, the next World Cup. They went by boat and they got there and they're completely knackered and they lost and they came back. So there was, it had also this effect, kind of direct effect. But yeah, it knocked back Italian football. It took away a lot of their best players. Mazzola was still pretty young. And there's a kind of side story about Mazzola, which is his son, Sandro, who was very young at the time of the crash, goes on to be as good a player as his dad, which is an amazing story in itself. There are lots of stories connected to that story. But yes, it knocks back Italian football, perhaps until the mid-60s, for various reasons. And then it starts to come back very strongly. But it's a tough blow to take.
Baci Galupo, Ballarin, Maroso, Grezza.
The last pre-Giro, Giro Vagando, Kilometer Zero, a game coming out next week. Sierra Alfa, a special report from Fran Reyes, who goes behind the scenes of Pogacar's pre-Giro high-altitude hideaway in the Sierra Nevada to find out how the Slovenian is laying the foundations for his attempt to make history this summer. Fran, I think I knew that it snowed up there. Do you know why? I've been looking at the Instagram posts of various riders who are up there at the moment. I think Ineos Grenadiers are up there. And actually, do you know who else I think is up there? I think Tadej Pogacar went up there. He went across Spain. Don't know whether he flew, don't know whether he drove, long journey anyway, down to Granada and then up to the Sierra Nevada. And I think that's where he's preparing the Giro d'Italia. And Fran, do you know what? I've just had, as we're talking and just remembering how close you are to the Sierra Nevada, I've had a bit of an idea. Fran, this year, as you know, Pogacar's going for the double, the first double since Marco Pantani in 1998. But I am intrigued. I'd like to know how he's going to go about it and how he's going to go about preparing for this double attempt. A lot of talk about, well, whether he's going to be too tired when the Tour de France comes around, how he's going to stay fresh. If the Giro this year, being only 40-something thousand meters of climbing, if it's a lighter Giro and that will facilitate this double bid. But how would you feel, Fran, about investigating for donning your deerstalker hat, your detective's hat, and heading up from your home in Granada to the Sierra Nevada? How would you feel about that, Fran? Do you accept your mission?
I do, man. I have driven up to Sierra Nevada 7 or 10 times this year already. So why not another more? I can go this afternoon if you want and try and find out who is up there.
Wow, what a quick turnaround. What a very spontaneous...
Yeah, my day was looking so boring, you know, and now, thanks to you, it is going to be much better.
The version of himself that we saw in the 2023 Tour de France, was it a lesser one, you know, a weaker one compared to his top shape?
Yeah, of course, when you have broken the arms and when you come to the Tour, he's training 1 month and you finish second, then he's, for me, it's incredible. So you don't train like 2-3 weeks and you come to the Tour, and especially when you crash in the Liège and you know, you come to the Tour de France and you finish second, you win 2-3 stages. For my opinion, it's big success.
And it is still feasible for him on a lesser version.
Yeah.
To still take 2 weeks to finally explode.
Yeah.
And to finish second.
Yeah, I said the same.
This year we have this challenge of the GT double.
Uh-huh.
Tell me something. Having these kind of challenges in the team, is it a motivation for you as a rider, as a domestic, to know that you are chasing such a big goal?
This guy, he can make it. I want to say he can make it with Giro and Tour, both. because I did also like one before the GC, but I try not to do it three times Giro Tour. And this guy, but I don't do it for GC, I do it for the stages. I'm happy. And this guy, I think so, he can do it. Really. He's such a big talent. He trained now a lot, but after the Giro, he needs a little bit rest, low altitude, and already done. When you don't have nothing problem, healthy problem before the Tour, I think so this guy can make big surprise everybody.
Now I know from my experience that you need quite long to the body needs quite long to recover. Even if your mind is ready to go on the bike, you want to go to push, the body needs to recover from anything broken or any damage to the body. It affects the preparations. Yeah, it affects the mental part as well. But I hope everybody can recover as fast as possible and be on the altitude training camps as fast as possible to prepare for the Tour, because I know how important it is to have as much time as possible, and it's still some time to Tour, but the clock is ticking anyway. I'm that kind of person, of course, that I always want to race against the best, and Jonas is probably the best climber in the world, and for the Tour he's always the best. So yeah, I wish that he comes back on the same level like before, and that we can have again a good go.
Now for the episodes that friends will already find in their Kilometer Zero feeds, having hit the airwaves in the last couple of weeks. First up, the fascinating story of Jack Burke, which we gave the same title as the book, part memoir, part manual, that Jack published last year, How to Become a Pro Cyclist. The episode features a long interview with Jack and the following clip, also starring his longtime mentor, the former pro Swain Tuft, gives you a nice idea of what to expect. In the book, you talk quite a lot about mentors, and I think, for example, one key mentor was Swain Tuft. He was already in the picture at this point. Just talk to us a little bit about, well, how he entered your life, and it was him entering your life, I think, not vice versa. And, some of the key precepts that you've taken from him, and maybe that have taken a little while in some cases to sort of sink in for you to fully grasp what he was getting at.
Yeah, I mean, this is where I got far luckier than most guys, is I had unbelievable mentors in my life, and like people that reached out and helped me with it. I got more help than I knew what to do with. And Swain, for example, he was the first one. And I mean, I'd say after my mom, he was the most significant mentor in my life. Like, that guy has given me way too much of his time for free.
You know, going back to Jack, and just, I was always keeping an eye on Canadian riders, right? And I was always trying to follow what guys were doing at the North American races. And I'd seen that he had done well in a stage. I think he won a stage of a race called San Dimas, which is kind of like similar to a Redlands. And you know, the racing has changed a lot in North America. It was quite a healthy scene back then when Jack was doing that race. So what you did in those kinds of races really mattered. And I remember going, like, I think he was on the radar of like I also work with this group called Bridge the Gap, and you know, like, it's all about helping young riders kind of make that next step if we can, if it's just like some tickets somewhere to get to a training camp or to a race or something like that. So I had access to his email, and I remember just writing him and saying, hey man, like, good job, because that was my thing. I was always trying to see like who's coming up and then who could actually use help, right? Because some people, they're very well off. They're very, you know, their parents are taking care of things. And so I like to figure out people's deals and see if there's like a way you can accelerate. Because I know for myself, I was a bit of a special case. But by the time I actually, when I really needed help as a rider, there was nothing. There was not a single thing there helping you along the way. And then when you made it, those things all pop up out of the woodworks. And I'm like, well, it's nice to get this stuff now, but I certainly needed it like 2-3 years ago, right? So in my mind, the help that you can give is really like trying to find those younger riders in those early development years who truly need it, who don't have like a big support base around them. I remember just riding Jack, and I think we had a chat on a rest day because, yeah, rest days are busy, but, you know, to talk to someone back home, it's sometimes nice. It's sometimes taking you out of your own little bubble, your own little world. So, yeah, you do all your other catch-ups. And then I remember talking to Jack, and he was just, I will say, like, he's one of those guys, his energy is quite infectious, like, in the sense of he's just so into what he's doing. And I think that really comes out in the book when you read about how many times he ran into roadblocks and things like this that were like, most people would have just packed it in. And this guy just keeps going and going. He just shifts course, recalibrates, and he's like right back at it again, you know? So I could sense that right away. In my mind, I was like, oh, this is a guy who, you know, doesn't have a huge support system and hopefully would be receptive to a lot of the kind of, in life, you quite often have to learn things the hard way. But if you can have someone there who's been through it, who you maybe respect, you can really dodge quite a few nasty bullets, I think. And that was my only goal with Jack, is to really try and share my experience, because I think very like-minded in the way we went about stuff, right? It's kind of that stubborn, like, I'm just going to go and give her and see what happens until like the wheels fall off, you know? So yeah, that's kind of my recollection of that whole period.
2016, I'd gotten a great result at a race in California, and then I got an email from him, and I thought it was a joke, like, because I knew who this guy was. I'd never spoken to him, and I suddenly have an email from him. I'm like, okay, who is this really? Like, you know, haha, whatever. And he's racing the Giro at the time and saying he wants to chat on the phone just to see how it's going, like, on his rest day. And I'm like, dude, like, you're at the Giro. Why you want to talk to me? Like, why do you know about some race in California? And yeah, that just spiraled into, he taught me a lot.
My thing is that I always want to kind of reiterate that this is a really long road. Even if you're super talented, it's like you've got to have like a long-term understanding and a real love for it. Because if you don't love it, you're not going to continue doing it, because it's just too fucking, even if like the money's great and all this other stuff, it's just too hard. Like, you have to love the sport. And so when I talk to younger riders nowadays, that's kind of my first objective, is to kind of suss out how much did they love this, first of all, because quite often you'll talk to young riders who are very delusional, and you also get the feeling that they don't love it, like really love it. And, you know, that's going to be a tough road, hard to work with. Let's put it that way.
Next up, it's more life lessons, this time from a bike rider who's not trying to establish himself in the pro ranks, but build a future outside elite cycling, having spent a decade in the World Tour. His voice and story are familiar to regular listeners of the Cycling Podcast. He retired in January. His name is Joe Dombrowski, and I journeyed to Nice to frog march him down memory lane in March. Incidentally, all friends are invited, should already have been invited, to our first ever Kilometer Zero live event. That is a virtual event in which Joe, Larry Warbass and I will be talking all things Giro d'Italia, and you, that is the friends, will be able to ask us questions. The event is taking place next Monday, so the 29th of April at 7 p.m. UK time, or 8 p.m. Central European time.
So where we are right now is called Che Roba Capiu, which is neither Italian or French. It is actually Nisart. I was told about this by my OG Nisois neighbors. And Roba Capiu essentially means, Che Roba Capiu means the dock of the stolen cap. The reason being that you come around the horn here from the port, there's often a stiff headwind, and it is said to knock your hat off your head.
Your hat off. And it's also, Joe, I mean, we're talking about your future as a real estate magnate, this rather splendid looking building, this palazzo, as you say in Italian, on the Roba Capiu is for sale.
It is.
Four rooms. Well, that must be one of the flats has four rooms. There's the phone number.
We might have to give him a call.
Yeah, I think we should. The property investments and perhaps the start of Joe's career in real estate could wait for another day. I told him that from the Promenade des Anglais, or a bar facing in that direction from Nice's old flower market to be precise, we were about to embark on a journey down memory lane, beginning, well, where it all began for the Cycling Podcast and Joe, with that Young Americans Friend Special in 2016.
Oh, it's been a really good move for me, and I love it.
It seems on the face of it a better fit. It's an American team, and it is a team that has been the home in the last few years to guys who are maybe a little bit quirky. I mean, is that a fair description?
Yeah. I don't know if I'm quirky, but I suppose, yeah. I feel like I fit in well there.
But I guess Sky's different in that it's got a very mixed record with young riders. I mean, Ian's an example of a guy who's done really well there, but there aren't that many. I mean, Luke Rowe's another one, but an awful lot of young riders have not, because they don't necessarily give the opportunity to young riders.
I think the difficulty in Sky in terms of development of neopros is it's so easy for a young rider to get lost in a team like that because of what their focuses are. You know, it's such a deep team in terms of when you have the budget to sign, you know, some of the best riders in the world to be your fourth guy on a mountain day.
Well, Joe, we finished our promenade. Promenade des.
So the promenade.
Promenade d'un Irlandais and an Américain. But, Joe, we thought we'd take you back through podcast memory lane and revisit some of your long and distinguished story with the cycling podcast. And that clip that we have just refreshed our memory about was from 2016. That was maybe the first thing you did with the cycling podcast, and our late great leader Richard Moore came down here to the Côte d'Azur, I think.
Yes,
and he met up with you, Larry, Ian Boswell. You were all bright young things then, stars in your eyes, and great futures ahead of you. You still got a great future ahead of you, Joe.
Yes.
But what does it make you when you think back to that time? And in that interview, you obviously relived. You talked about your experience with Team Sky. You'd already been a pro for a while. But when you think back to 2016 and that experience with Richard as well, what does it conjure up?
Yeah, I mean, I guess looking at it now, we felt I feel that I was so young. You know, so much that you don't know, and you know, the experience over time that you kind of see things differently. And I think that's also just life. Like, I'm sure 10 years from now, whatever I may be doing, I'll look back at where I was right after my cycling career and you think, like, I didn't know anything. And that's how it should be. I think every year you should almost be embarrassed about what you didn't know the year before. But it was also a really fun time. I mean, I don't want to say that I loved racing my bike throughout my career, and it was a great time, and I wouldn't say I had less fun as things went on, but it was a time where everything was still so new. And even just being here in Nice, we had, you know, me, Larry, and Ian all together, and there was this element of probably the closest thing I could compare it to is being off at university with your friends, first time away from home, and there's all these new experiences that, you know, even outside of the bike racing side of things that are just, it was a lot of fun.
Of the three of you there, so as it turns out, Larry is the last of the Mohicans.
Yes.
if I'd asked you, I'm sure you were always honest and candid with us on the podcast, but if you'd have been even more honest, maybe, even more transparent, maybe back then in 2016 or even earlier when you all sort of came over here together pretty much around about the same time, what kind of careers did you think you personally think the three of you would have?
I mean, I thought we all had pretty high ceilings in terms of our trajectories. Of course, like, you're always biased in your own thinking, you know, like what I think of myself and what I can achieve, at least for most people, is probably more than what a lot of people think that I could achieve. So I would say that was still a point in my career where, you know, that was my, I don't know, third season in the peloton. And
you're still kind of making enough progress, but also there's enough sort of room for progress that you thought, okay, well, maybe I could turn into a real winner at the World Tour level, or, you know, become a GC rider in Grand Tours or whatever. And in the end, I wouldn't say that really happened, but you feel that that's a possibility still. Whereas after year 6, 7, 8, you start to kind of see where your place is, and there's still room for improvement. And you see guys that even in their early 30s make big jumps forward, because performance is something that is so nuanced, and, you know, there's a lot of, can be environmental, can, there's so many things that affect performance, and that can happen. But I guess over 6 or 7 years, and you see this also reflected in, you know, kind of, maybe the best way to say it is like the multiples that riders trade on in terms of their salaries. You know, when you're young and there's a lot of hope of future growth potential, the multiple is quite high. As you get older, you know, it's like you're paid you're paid for what you produce. And there isn't that sparkle. And I would say that's a point in your career where, both from your own perspective, but maybe also from the teams, there's still this kind of glimmer of hope of what could be.
Finally, it's another episode that friends will already find in their feed, an introduction to the man charged, at least in part, with reinventing the team formerly known as Team Sky and now competing under the nom de guerre Ineos Grenadiers. His name is John Allott. He's the team's new CEO, and I met him at Paris-Nice for the episode we called Diary of a CEO. This is the last clip, so I wish you all enjoyable listening and a great weekend, and I'll be back for our XL Giro preview early next week. We're going to wind the clock back. I sort of said to you, well, when we were setting this interview up, I wanted to talk a little bit more about your background, so people can get to know where you've come from. And it's a sort of an untypical story. I mean, you just told me outside that you never really envisaged working in sport. Let's just go right back to the start. Born in South Australia, I think I'm right in saying. Just tell me a little bit about your education, what kind of family you grew up in, and maybe where some seeds were planted for where you are now.
Yeah, so I was born in 1969 in country South Australia, which now of course plays host to the Tour Down Under. Sports loving family background that comes with the nationality, particularly around cricket, Australian rules football. But I do remember actually in 1979 as a kid seeing a very cheesy American film called Breaking Away, that was the first, it was literally the first time I'd had the Tour de France even kind of mentioned in my life. That was not part of my upbringing at all.
Terrible confession I have to make. I always get them mixed up. Is Breaking Away the Kevin Costner one, or is that American Flyers? One of them, I'm always told that I'm a little bit like the protagonist because he sort of models his life on, well, Italian. He kind of becomes a bit of a plastic Italian, and he becomes obsessed with bike racing. And the other one features Kevin Costner, and I can't remember which one's which.
No, it's most certainly not the Kevin Costner one. it's cheesy, but not that cheesy. It's the story of a group of, you know, American kids, effectively, who discover road cycling and the romance and wonder of Grand Tour riding in Europe. And to me, back then, that just seemed so distant and such an amazing kind of foreign concept. But yeah, like all kids, you know, I rode my bike. I never raced a bike. I was never particularly amazing at sport. I was a bit of a schoolboy runner, but that was about it, and never foresaw that my career path would ever end up where it has.
And the route into sport was marketing, which was what you did decide to do. So just tell us how, well, the first big organisation I think that you were a part of was the McLaren Formula One racing team. Tell us about the path into McLaren. How did you get there?
Yeah, so I moved to the UK about 20 years ago, and with an agency, marketing agency, and the first new client that I picked up there was McLaren. I met Ron Dennis, now Sir Ron Dennis, in 2004, and very quickly struck up a relationship and a rapport with Ron. He outlined the vision that he had for that business and his desire to build a globally famous brand around high-end sports cars and Formula One and technology. And before I knew it, I was part of that world. And you know, it was a rapid learning curve for me. Amazing days. You know, we had incredible ups. You know, I started around the same time as Lewis Hamilton making his debut. Worked with Lewis. Worked with Fernando Alonso, Jenson Button, a number of amazing Formula One riders. But also, you know, I had ultimately 14 years at McLaren, and it was like every year was like an intensive MBA in understanding politics and commercial and sport and working with elite athletes. And in some ways, I guess it's set me up perfectly for doing what I'm doing now.
So, well, that MBA sort of in working with athletes, you were having quite a lot of contact with the drivers as well at that time.
Yeah, we'd have a lot of contact with the drivers. Obviously, the drivers had significant kind of commercial aspects to what they did. Typically, I seemed to always be the person that had to say no to all sorts of weird and wacky things that they wanted to do. But equally, I found a number of opportunities or developed opportunities for them to have fun. I created a cartoon series for Lewis and Jensen called Tuned way back in 2010, 2011. You know, I can remember designing baseball caps with Fernando Alonso with a bunch of crayons on the floor of the paddock facility in Austin, Texas. So yeah, I had a lot of fun. And they're unique and interesting characters, Formula One drivers, but they're really not that dissimilar to elite riders in the peloton.
Maybe we'll talk in a minute about Formula One and how it's changed, maybe even since you left. But you know, just when you talk there about the sort of scale of Formula One and the scale of those organisations, I was watching Drive to Survive, and I'm not a big Formula One fan either, but I have sort of absorbed a bit of it through that series. I think it was the Mercedes team, and Toto Wolff referred to 2,000 employees would be celebrating a victory, I think, last year. And I suppose that gives some idea of the scale of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a huge scale. You know, when I started with McLaren the beginning of 2007, I think there were 1,100 people in the team. I think by the time I left in 2020, there were something like 2,000. There were about 5,000 employees at McLaren in total, which is quite extraordinary. And yeah, that Netflix effect has had a massive impact on that sport. I was one of the first signatures on that Drive to Survive contract back when it was first conceived, and I don't think anybody, including me, could have foreseen quite the impact it would have had, particularly in growing the US market. And here's hoping the comparable series in cycling, Unchained, is in the process of doing the same thing for us.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.